please give a warm welcome to Mr. Robert Graham.
Thank you. I want to thank Alex for presenting this program in the format that he is, because it just rolls out nicely, as Henry pointed out. And so I'm following on Henry, and I think all the others will follow this way. The driving force, well, let me ask some questions first. I always like to do this. How many of you have an existing cannabis business? Raise your hands. Okay. How many of you are here exploring the idea of going into a cannabis business? Okay, good. Kind of evenly balanced. All right. We started out discussing 280E in the idea of business formation, because that is the driving force as to how you set up your business. And no business falls into a cookie cutter concept. Each business is different. So what may work for somebody else is not necessarily going to work for you. Each set of facts for each business is dependent, how you set it up and how you move it forward is dependent upon the unique circumstances of your business. So, formation. Many of you have probably gone online and looked how easy it is to file documents with the Secretary of State. Well, you don't need a lawyer for that. You can just go on the website. You can file your articles. You can pull off on the website a operating agreement. You get your IRS number and check all the boxes. Boom, you're ready to go. That's what the OHA and OLCC say you got to have, is an entity registered with the Secretary of State. That is just the beginning of formation. The initial step about operating agreement or it's articles of incorporation, bylaws, shareholder agreement, that's just the beginning of the process. And I want to have this discussion today or talk about, and I want to leave your two expressions in your mind. One of those expressions is, quote, piercing the corporate veil. The second expression is statutory rescission. You won't necessarily see those tied together with the words of business formation. But as a business lawyer, I'm not looking for the good stuff. I'm looking for the stuff that's going to create problems. So formation comes down to corporate formalities. If you don't follow corporate formalities, a creditor, a person who's seeking to sue the business, can end up suing you personally. So we've gone to this extent to give you the information of how to set up a business, giving you the structure to prevent personal liability for the tax issues as well as contractual issues. But if you don't then operate it properly, all that planning, all that effort, all that thought goes out the window, because you open yourself up to personal liability if you don't follow corporate formalities. And what am I talking about? I'm talking about corporate minutes, the documentation that should be done at least annually, but better quarterly, where you sit down and you put together, in essence, a summary of what you've done, the supporting contracts is behind it, and then you actually say, we approve it. Because that's the only way you can prove to anybody that the corporation has actually approved a contract or approved an expenditure of money. It's not just, we wrote the check out of the corporate checking book, or we signed the contract in the name of the corporation. There has to be documentation behind it that, in fact, the corporation in the embodiment of the board of directors or the members actually approves it. And you got to document it, and you got to put it in your file. So why is this so important? Why are we talking about that? Well, as I go through these rules with the OLCC, and I look at what they've done previously in regards to the alcohol business, you're likely to get audited by the OLCC in regards to your business, which will include all of your minutes. That's significant. You've got to have your business in shape if you're going to apply for an OLCC license. Many of you who are in the growers business have different contracts. You've got a lease, you've got maybe a forward contract with a wholesaler or a dispensary or a processor. You've got employment agreements, you've got independent contractors agreements. There's a lot of things that you've collected in a file folder. Well, you got to take that file folder and make it into something more than just some dot papers in a file. So that's very important to do this, and you got to do it on a regular basis. Between now and January, it's only, what, maybe 115 days to January 1st. I mean, we're that close. The world is going to be different. And a lot of you are going to be applying for an OLCC license. If you haven't started thinking about the process of getting your business formed and organized now, and making those arrangements now, come January 1st, it's going to be a long line. And if you're not ready and you're deficient, that line is going to get longer. So I urge you, begin now, sit down with your business documents, figure out what you need to document what you're doing. Because we've gone to all this trouble to put you in a situation where your personal assets are not exposed. We put you into C-Corp. But if you don't follow the formalities, that C-Corp can be pierced. And as I pointed out, this documenting your business is vitally important. I've litigated these cases before, and that's the first thing you look for. Where are the corporate minutes? You can backdate them, but all that comes out in discovery. So you know that before the lawsuit was ever filed, there weren't any corporate minutes, just some lawyers got together after the lawsuit was filed and threw it together. That's not the embodiment of the idea of corporate governance and keeping your documentation in order. So when somebody sues you personally to get your assets because you had a problem with the business, you walked away from it, it's either in bankruptcy or it's just defunct. You don't want to be saddled with those liabilities. So do the little bit of work necessary to keep up on it. Now I want to draw your attention to the other term, statutory rescission. I'm referring to the ability of investors to get their money back when their investment goes bad in your cannabis business because you didn't do the proper documentation of the investment they made with you. The rules are that for every security, which is a stock, a bond, a note, promissory note, a convertible note, preferred stock, all of those are security. And the rule is, if it's not registered with the Securities Exchange Commission, it can't be sold unless there's a proper exemption. And those exemptions are under the Securities Exchange Commission rules and under the State Department of Corporate Finance rules. You've got to follow the bouncing ball. So here's the classic example. A company goes out, they raise $500,000 through a private placement. They do everything to get the money in, but they fail to do one thing, and that's file the proper documentation with the state and with the Securities Exchange Commission. So the investment goes along for a year. The business gets in trouble. It's upside down. The investors who put in $500,000 want to get a return on their investment, and you say, hey, sorry, it didn't work out. But you're a sophisticated investor. You took the risk. And the investor goes back and looks at things and realizes you didn't follow the bouncing ball. You didn't file the right things. You didn't do it right. So what happens? They file an action for rescission because you failed to comply with the securities laws. Now you've gone all this trouble to set up the corporation so you protect yourself against, you know, creditors. But here you've got an investor who wants his money back. And under the rules, both state and federal law, that investor gets his money back because you didn't comply with the rules. So you got to make sure that when you're taking in other people's money, that you're taking it in properly and you're documenting it properly so that you don't face liability based upon the fact you didn't do it right. And there's a lot of liability out there. How many of you are in the extraction business? Some of these extractors, excess of $150,000, if you get all the bells and whistles that go along with it. So you got to get an investor to come in and get it, unless you're paying it out of your cash flow. So there's a lot of investors out there who have put a lot of money out there and expecting a return on investment. And sadly, many of them think it's a green rush, that there's going to be just a mountain of green money coming down the pike. Well, there could be significant returns on investment, but you got to do it right. And if you don't do it right, you're going to be paying that money back to your investors. So I want to conclude my remarks by again pointing out formation is merely setting it up and checking some boxes. Governance along with it is what makes the formation and the operation of the business protect you from the liability, and that's why you created the entity in the first place. So we're going to open up for questions, and we look forward to talking and responding to your inquiries.
Sure. I saw your hand first, and then I see there's lots of questions. We'll do our best to get to everybody. We don't have a lot of time.
Yes, hello. My name is Ben McInnes again. And it's just one question. It ties into, I saw some disconcerting news in Colorado where they disallowed someone to declare bankruptcy corporately. And my concern was, was that a misread? Was it personal and they pierced the corporate veil? Or is the C Corp only effective if the state recognizes it as such? You see what I'm saying? Because the C Corp's great, you don't have any personal liability if it declares bankruptcy, but if they say you're not protected under bankruptcy laws, it seemed like to me I'm under square one, back to square one, but I don't know that. And then sort of as a follow-up to that, within the Reg D, like if you're going to use a Reg D exemption or whatever exemption you used, it seems like, does that have the same restrictions because you're filing an exemption with the federal government that's based on a Schedule I controlled substance? Can they get out of the loophole? So
I'm going to answer the question in kind of reverse order. The issue is, because you're in the cannabis business and it's a controlled substance, is your business not going to be allowed the exemptions under the federal securities laws? Some of you may remember back in the 80s, the Mustang Ranch case, where the Mustang Ranch in Nevada, which was a brothel, did a public offering of securities. And a number of people challenged that filing for the issuance for the public offering of securities. They raise it. Well, that's illegal under the law. And the Securities Exchange Commission, to their credit, said, look, we're only here to administer the federal securities laws. We're not in the prostitution business. Likewise with cannabis. And they found no reason to not approve the filing for the initial public offering for Mustang Ranch. So there is precedent, which I think we're comfortable with, that those same securities exemptions which apply to any other business will be applicable to cannabis. In regard to bankruptcy law, I'm familiar with that case that came out that denied bankruptcy protection in a particular instance. I'm not a bankruptcy lawyer, but now that case is really opening up the impetus to really get some bankruptcy review from experienced bankruptcy lawyers on that issue, and that is a relatively new case. So I can't respond to that question directly.
Hi. I'm wondering, if you have an established brand already and you are, say, an S-corp...
Where are you?
Right here.
Oh, okay.
An S-corp or an LLC, is it possible to change that entity to a C-corp, and what does that involve?
Well, yes. Actually, a number of dispensaries that are in that have been in existence that were S-corps did transition. You can make a one-time election. You could consult with your attorney or your accountant how to do it. It's best to do it at the end of, at the very end of your fiscal year, so you begin the next fiscal year as a C Corp. But you can do it. And I would encourage you to do it for the reasons that I stated.
Yeah, this question is for Henry. In regards to the 280E, and you talked about filing expenses towards non-trafficking versus trafficking, how careful do you have to be with that balance? For instance, if only 10% of your revenue comes from non-trafficking items, can you still file 50% of your rent expenses to that, or is it kind of gray?
Well, you know what? You stumbled on what I think will be the next big issue that we intend to raise in tax court, and if we don't get the result we want there, we'll go to the Ninth Circuit like we did in Olive. But essentially, his question was, as well, if your non-cannabis items only comprise 10% of your income, are you limited to only 10% of your expenses? And I would argue, absolutely not. In the Champ case, what I argued and the judge accepted was I said, look, Champ was one of the original dispensaries in California, and they really did what the dispensaries are supposed to do. They provided massages, they provided psychotherapy, they had a clean needle program, they had food for people that were indigent and couldn't eat, they provide hygiene materials, toothbrushes, et cetera, to people, they did social functions, et cetera, and so forth. I said, look, if this was Macy's and the perfume counter took up 15% of the floor space, then you would allocate 15% of your overhead to the perfume counter, and the other 85% would be allocated to everything else. And the judge said, I agree with that. Let's do the allocation. And he went right down the line. If you look at the Champ case, he allowed 85% of their expenses to be deducted, and he disallowed 15% associated with the trafficking. He disallowed those. And for those of you who aren't familiar with Champ, to put that case in perspective, when we began the trial, the IRS was looking for about $475,000 in back taxes. At the end of the case, the judge gave them $4,900. 1% of what they asked for. They were so embarrassed, they never even tried to collect it.
This question is for Robert. Robert, this morning there was talk of outside investment coming into Oregon, specifically for company formation. and there was talk of fingerprinting and background checks for those investors. My question is, if the money comes through, let's say, a fund, and there's a principal of that fund, but there's 20 members of that fund, would all 20 members then also need the fingerprinting and background checks of their spouses as well in order for that money to come into an Oregon entity?
As I understand the proposed rules, that is a reality. I think it's wrong, it's draconian. As I understand it, it's intended to flush out cartel money or something. I think one of the realities is we're going to have to prove that your investment is with what we call seasoned money, the money that you can document where it came from and how it ended up being invested. I think that's unnecessary. I think it's wrong. But I'm afraid that those are the rules that the OLCC is going to set up. And so I go back to my thing about documenting the investors, the money that comes in. Absolutely make sure you've done your due diligence as to everything about your investors that come in. I use this expression. When my kids were small, I would talk to them about stranger danger. And that's how I look at investors, particularly when they're strangers to you. And they just, somehow you hook up, you've got a business, you're looking for investors, and investors come in. And you don't know much about them. You got to have some good due diligence about who they are. But again, you come back to your question, and yeah, they're going to be tracking everybody. And so some of these large funds that are coming in, they may have a couple hundred names attached to it.
Hi there. Hey, my name is Laura.
Let me just add something onto that, if you don't mind, Laura. No,
sure.
This will just take a second. I really think that due diligence is one of the best insurance policies that you can buy in operating any business in this industry. Know who you're dealing with and know what their backgrounds are. It's insurance for you, and it's insurance for the people that you serve. Laura?
Thanks. So my question is for you, Henry. With a C corporation, you were saying is the most sheltering business entity, and you were saying that it's best for the retailer. I wonder if that still applies to the growing side, the wholesaling side, or a vertically integrated company as well. You would recommend the C corporation for that also?
Well, if you were vertically integrated, the answer to that would be yes, because it's one corporation and you want to, it's one entity and you want to give yourself as an owner of that entity as much protection as possible. One of the things that I will point out is that there has never been an attempt by the IRS that I'm aware of, and I follow this stuff pretty closely, to apply 280E to a grower of cannabis. Different accounting rules apply to agriculture, and so far people that are just cultivators have not had that problem. I would think that for somebody who is a processor, my advice regarding a C corporation would apply. By the way, I didn't say this when I was speaking, but I should have. Most accountants will tell you that, the problem with a C corp is that you subject yourself to double taxation because the retained earnings are taxed, and then when they're distributed as dividends, they're taxed again to the people who receive them. Quite honestly, in this industry where the corporations are small, I don't see that as being a big problem because, you can make salary adjustments, you can give bonuses. There are all sorts of tax strategies that can be followed that eliminate the exposure to a dual taxation.
Hello, my name is Sarah, Novick Industries. My question is in relation to getting audited by the IRS. Let's say I obtain my my recreational cannabis growing license in January. My business is successful, going for 2 or 3 years, boom, the cannabis business gets audited. What is the likelihood, and is it okay for the IRS to go back to prior years and look at my non-cannabis related businesses and audit those as well, and how far can they go back?
Okay, fair question. Basically, they do go, I mean, usually they select you for 1 year and they go back one and they go forward one. That's a very common practice. For civil tax, there's a 3-year statute of limitations. It's 3 years from when you file the return. So generally, you've got about 4 years of exposure for every year you're thinking. So let's say you had a dispensary or a retail outlet that was open in 2014, you would file your tax return in 2015, and then the 3-year statute would begin to run. So it would expire in 2018. They can't go back more than 3 years.
Another question on the C Corp. If you had a holding company that was the parent to multiple businesses, would you advise only the retail establishment to be a C Corp and the ancillary businesses and the holding company to be LLCs? Or would you advise all of the businesses to be C Corp?
I think that I'd have to know more about the corporate structure and look at it and find out from you what it was that you were trying to do and how you were going about doing it to give you any meaningful advice on that. Sorry.
And I think that's the point that I tried to make, that each entity is a different animal. It's personalities, it's your financing, it's everything. So what may work for one business doesn't necessarily work for the other, and it's custom made.
Hi, from what I understand, if you have an LLC or a corporation, you can still file a C Corp with either or, is that correct?
I think that what you're talking about is that if you're an LLC, you can elect to be treated for tax purposes as a corporation. And I know that some accountants think that that is an effective strategy for dealing with this. I will tell you that there is not a tax court case on point on that. It may work, it may not, but I think that based on the amount of money that's at stake for most of the people that we've represented, it's probably not a risk worth taking. But I do know that you can set yourself up as an LLC and elect to be treated for tax purposes as a corporation.
As far as the taxes go, and I know you guys kind of touched on it a little bit earlier, what if all of your items, so say you're, you know, the grower, the wholesaler, and the processor, well, all of your items are what they call trafficable or trafficable items. As far as taxes go, how do you file on those, or how do you, the money that you make from that, I mean, is that, would they call that all trafficable items? I mean, the IRS, that is?
I'm not sure I understand the question. I mean, for instance, if you're a cultivator and you sell your weed to a retailer, mm-hmm. that's a wholesale transaction, that's not retail. As I covered a couple minutes ago, so far nobody's tried to apply 280E to cultivators or producers. I think you then sell the product to the retailer. What the retailer pays for the product is their cost of goods sold. That, of course, is a reduction to income. So I think that answers your question, if I understand it.
For a lot of us have patients in a medical side, is there any advantage to, and we want to continue that as well as when we move into the retail market, is there any advantage to putting that in a nonprofit? No, for the if you're growing for patients and putting that business under a nonprofit.
Well, okay, this is somewhat of a complicated area. First of all, in order to be a true nonprofit, you have to get 501c3 status from the IRS, and nobody in the industry has ever gotten it, okay? So in California, which is a not-for-profit state, everybody runs themselves as though they were a nonprofit, but technically they can't be. But I don't see any advantage under 280E one way or the other, because 280E doesn't care. It's just based on the income and the disallowance of your expenses. Complicated area, and it's hard to get your arms around, but I encourage you to spend the time to do it, because it's out there and it's going to be an issue, and this is one that's not going away anytime soon.